Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's more recognizing where are we not really seeing who this kid is. And once we understand that, then we can get curious about where they are right now and how can we scaffold skill development and really get to know who they are on such a deep level that we can fluidly move through learning opportunities and then recognize, oh, today's not the day for this, or, oh, but I see an opening, let's work on this. So which is going back to that idea of being deeply connected, the more closely attuned to our child we are, the better able we'll be to capitalize on those learning opportunities.
That was Debbie Reber on Psychologists Off the Clock.
We are four experts in psychology here to bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas from psychology to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, a clinical psychologist practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado, and author of Act for Burnout, Act Daily Journal, and the Act Daily Card Deck.
From America's Heartland, I'm Dr. Emily Edlin, a clinical psychologist based in Chicago, Illinois, and author of Autonomy Supportive Parenting.
Calling in from Vienna, Austria, I'm Michael Herold, ACT coach, confidence trainer, and author of an upcoming book on being a better conversationalist and making friends.
And from coastal New England, I'm Dr. Jill Stoddard, author of Be Mighty, The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, and Imposter No More.
We hope you take what you learn here to build a rich and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
Hi, everyone. It's Emily, and I'm here with Michael today for our first rookie co-host intro.
Newbie co-host intro. Yay.
Yay. So it feels a little bit like we're kind of like the kids hanging out, pretending to adult while the parents are out.
Yeah, we're totally adulting here. Totally. I'm so glad we're not releasing video for the co-host intro.
I appreciate, Michael, your interest in introducing this episode with me. I have tended towards parenting and all about the kids and parents, and I know that's just not your life, even though you grew up as a child and had parents, right?
It seems that's true. No, but I will say, and I know I've told you this a couple of times in our team meetings, that what I love about your episodes so much is that they're just so easy and so intriguing to listen to. And I listen to them, of course, because I listen to all our episodes, because they're the best episodes out there, if I say so myself. But yours are, you're right, like they are as removed from my life as a raisin is from, you know, competitive salsa dancing, puberty, middle school, young athletes. Like, you know, I can relate to puberty because that's, you know, just 5, 6, 7 years ago. But everything else is a little bit removed. And it's so interesting to listen to your interviews and to get a glimpse into what life is like for other people than me.
Well, I take that as the highest compliment. So thank you. I'm curious what it was like for you listening to this episode about, and I was really excited to do this interview with Debbie Reber. She wrote this book, Differently Wired, years ago now. It came out in 2018. But it's amazing how she really started a movement towards talking about what we say neurodivergent now, but that wasn't even in the lexicon just a few years ago like it is now. And I actually really like her title even better, which is Differently Wired. So I've been excited to have her on to talk about the experience of raising differently wired kids. And even though it's removed from your experience, your personal life experience, I'm curious what you found helpful about listening to the episode.
there were a lot of things that I found useful and interesting to listen to. So I find that when I say useful, I'm talking about things that apply to my life directly, which I have a few things as well, but also her bringing in that language. She writes that being neurodivergent is a difference that's worth celebrating. And I think that is so important. And I've talked about this with Debbie, our Debbie, in a co-host intro recently, where we talked about how important it is to use the right language so that everyone feels like they're part of the team. And in this book, and in the interview, she does a really good job of explaining how that works. And I have to admit, I still feel a little bit insecure in my wording when I talk mm-hmm. about neurodivergent people, because I know for myself, as someone who's living with a disability, there are certain words that are quote unquote right, and there are words that are quote unquote not right or worse. Yeah. And it's a little bit tricky to guide people to find the right words. And I find myself in that terrain a little bit with the neurodivergent population, but she does a beautiful job of guiding us through the lens to see that, and you do as well.
Well, thank you. I mean, I really appreciate her whole philosophy about differences. And I think as a psychologist, you know, I studied the DSM and the categories and the labels. And this many years into my career, I still feel ambivalent about how I use those categories, diagnoses, and labels. They're so double-edged. I mean, they can be really useful for having a framework of understanding and a pathway for what to do next. And they can feel really limiting and not specific enough to each person. And so I think what I loved about this conversation about reading her book is this isn't about what to do to raise an autistic kid or a kid with ADHD, for example. It actually, this whole differently wired neurodivergence covers so much more territory than these diagnoses that we throw out there a lot and are talking about a lot. But even within those, kids can be so different in terms of what they need and how they show those needs. And we're, as parents, constantly like in translator mode.
Yeah. And by the way, so this is the one thing that I really highlighted metaphorically in this audio podcast was where she talks about, I think she calls it the most important thing, or you might have called it that, to be in tune with your child. And the example that both of you, you both have an example for this, for the lost in translation sort of mm-hmm. problem, where she's talking about a child who, again, quote unquote, misbehaves until the adults take a moment to figure out what just happened. Mm-hmm. And then you say something about one of your own children that mm-hmm. does something that seems lazy, but mm-hmm. there's a really understandable and really good reason for why this is happening. And I thought this is so eye-opening because, yes, that's exactly why this happened. And once you have lifted the veil and you explain, like, this is why the behavior occurs, it makes perfect sense. But until then, it just seems lazy. It seems careless. It seems not
defiant, right?
Yeah.
And think about how this could apply to all of our relationships, not just
exactly
parents
exactly.
and kids. Yeah. What is the why? You know, and
what
there's something on the surface that could be very different from what's under the surface. And so taking a pause to be curious about that instead of reactive, which the other thing I love about Debbie's work and her book and this interview is that she really centers the parent's experience rather than saying, this is how you do this to raise a great kid. It's more, this is how you take care of yourself to tune in and respond in ways to your child that just is better for everyone involved. And I really, really loved that.
Yeah. So maybe our parents listening can do some of that. She calls it conscious maintenance or self-care. Maybe they can do a little bit of that while they're listening to your most excellent interview.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, for helping me introduce this. And I really hope the listeners get a lot out of it. Debbie Reber is a parenting activist, best-selling author, speaker, and the CEO and founder of Tilt Parenting, a top-performing podcast, consultancy, and community with a focus on shifting the paradigm for parents raising and embracing neurodivergent children. Her most recent book, Differently Wired, A Parent's Guide to Raising an Atypical Child with Confidence and Hope, came out in 2018. After living abroad in the Netherlands for 5 years, Debbie, her husband, and Differently Wired teen moved to Brooklyn, New York in 2019. Debbie is an avid runner, traveler, and hiker, and claims reality shows as her guiltiest of pleasures. I had to add that last part because I join you in that.
Excellent.
So welcome to Psychologists Off the Clock, Debbie.
Thank you, Emily. I'm happy to be here.
So I'm actually going to start with the end of your book. The title of your last chapter is, If It Doesn't Exist, Create It. And I begin with this because what you've done with your platform, Tilt Parenting, is to create a community and philosophy that I don't remember existing before. And as a trained child psychologist, I've been around. So your book came out in 2018, and its message felt new back then, but seems much more part of the mainstream now. So I think you started a revolution for parenting neurodivergent or differently wired kids. So I wanted to start our discussion today with this philosophical shift that you've encouraged, from viewing neurodivergent kids as a problem that needs fixing to a difference worthy of celebrating. Mm. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. Thank you. I thought we were going to start with reality TV, but I'm happy to start with this.
We can go back to that.
But I'm happy to talk about this because I agree that when this book came out, it was hard to get it published because people weren't talking about things in this way. And it's been fascinating to see how things have changed.
Yeah. I mean, even the term neurodivergent or neurodiversity was not in the vocabulary when I was doing my PhD training back in the early 2000s.
Yeah. Neurodiversity as a term, I think, was just associated with the autistic movement, or the neurodiversity movement was paired with autism, and neurodivergent was not part of the vernacular. And one of the reasons why I started using the term differently wired was because I wanted a term that didn't feel like it was pathologizing neurodivergence or a medicalized term or that had a negative connotation.
And I appreciate that. You know, as a psychologist, I really struggle with this tension between the function of diagnoses and labels and categorization. Mm-hmm. And really the downsides of pigeonholing people with terms that end up becoming negatively associated as problems. Mm-hmm. And so I'd really like to talk more about how you see differently wired kids as having differences to celebrate.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the moment that I discovered that there were some real neurodifferences in my child and that our path was looking different, like all the messages were that this was a bad thing, like from day one, from teachers, from camp counselors, from, you know, the people we were looking for information, like this is a problem, you have to get on top of this. Like it was always deficit based and it was always focusing on how challenging a path this was going to be. And so both from the professionals and from the parent community that I was engaging with, you know, it was also seen as a problem or as an undesirable thing. And so I struggled with that from the beginning, as I know many parents do, because we see the incredible things about who our kids are and the strengths that come with their way of moving through the world and how they experience things and think about things. And so I just really wanted to, from the beginning, flip this paradigm and change the whole conversation. That was so important to me because not only are kids not broken, there's nothing wrong with them, but also there's so many of us, you know, like at what point is normal even a thing? At what point is there one way to be? And so I really just wanted to disrupt that whole conversation.
And I was thinking that as I was reading the beginning of your book, and I think a lot about this just in my work and in my personal life. When we think about neurodivergence or differently wired, and you start to add up all the potential differences, where does that become not even an anomaly anymore, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. If you think about the rates and the statistics and you put it all together, I mean, there's actually probably a pretty large portion of parents who are parenting neurodivergent kids and who are discovering their own neurodivergence yeah. in the process.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, our kids don't fall far from the tree. So, you know, my husband and I both have realized, oh, we've had a lot of those moments. And I've realized that I am totally ADHD and always have been. I had no idea. I was just, you know, the obnoxious kid who couldn't stop moving or talking as a child. I was a terrible student, but I got my stuff together, you know. But that's the case for so many of us. And I just think that we didn't have the language to identify things back then, right? It was, you know, it was all behavior focused. So there's good behavior or compliant kids, and then there's the bad kids. And it was a, you know, at least when I was growing up, it was very much the norm to be raised by parents in that authoritarian style, you know, very kind of top-down discipline, consequences, punishments, lots of punishments in my case. And so I think if we had the capacity to do so, we got in line, but we paid a price for it. And so I think it's a really exciting time now that so many adults are discovering their own wiring as part of parenting these kids. And I think it's also complicated because a lot of parents feel a sense of sadness for the child that they were who was so misunderstood. So yeah, it's just been a fascinating time. I think COVID also played a big role in this because people had a lot more time to notice and reflect on their own experience. So it's just been a fascinating couple of years in this space.
Not to mention during COVID, the homeschooling that was suddenly upon many parents, and they were witnessing their child learning, albeit in a very, you know, irregular environment, being on Zoom. However, I think it got a lot of parents' attention that maybe wouldn't have guessed before, oh, this is why they maybe come home saying bad stuff about school, or we're hearing a lot of comments from teachers, like, I'm watching the difficulty focusing or staying with a topic that's boring, you know, or these different things were right in front of parents' eyes for the first time.
That's exactly right. I had that experience because I ended up homeschooling my child very reluctantly from the time Ash was 9. It was like the start of third grade through eighth grade. Over the years, I became less and less reluctant. I kind of enjoyed it by the end. But I remember that first year observing my child, you know, trying to write something or trying to do something. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, I was like, I get it now. I don't know how this human could have, you know, coped in a traditional classroom setting with all the demands and expectations. Like, that was not happening. So I did have my eyes open pretty early, but I think you're right. Like, parents having that, you know, very kind of close up view of what's really going on, I think there was just a deeper understanding of where there might be learning disabilities and, you know, mm-hmm. trouble with reading or focus issues or sensory issues or all the things. Yeah.
All the things. Yes. So, well, maybe we should back up a little bit and even discuss what is differently wired. What does that encompass?
Yeah. So when I use the term differently wired, I am using it to kind of encompass any way of being neurodivergent. So it could be anything from ADHD or autism to being gifted, to having a learning disability, to being twice exceptional, which is gifted with some other neurodifference, sensory issues, all of the above. Maybe no diagnosis at all, but we recognize as a parent that this child is really not thriving in certain environments or circumstances. And yeah, so it's kind of an all-encompassing label, for lack of a better word. But really, again, the idea was to talk about it from a strengths-based perspective, or just like a, like, oh, isn't this interesting? There isn't one way to be, you know, we're all kind of unique. Our brains are all unique. We all experience the world differently.
Right. And even within all of those diagnoses or categories, there are so many differences for the unique child. What else is going on? How many do they kind of fall into? Mm-hmm. And how do each of those present for that child along with their unique strengths? And your book is not a how to parent a neurodivergent child, right?
No.
I think what I loved about it, this is right up my alley, is that it broke the mold in terms of centering the parent's experience. So a parenting book that's actually about the parent.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, as I said earlier, it was hard to get a publisher to get it because I wanted it to kind of launch the revolution, use that word when I designed Tilt. That's how I saw it. Mm-hmm. And I actually studied social change movements for a year before I developed Tilt to understand how to create content that would really get people invested and they would identify into the movement and then feel inspired to move forward. So mm-hmm. I did think of it as a revolution. And so I wanted the book to be part manifesto and then part mm-hmm. very kind of practical strategies, but yes, centering on us. It's not like how to get your kid to do X, Y, or Z.
Right.
I mean, there are some things in there that would be helpful, but really the way that we show up to these kids mm-hmm. and parent them and understand them and really lean into their neurodivergence is everything for how we feel and how our kids feel.
And how family life feels mm-hmm. every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And your book sort of functions as a memoir in the sense of you really track your experience of learning about your child and who they are as you're homeschooling, like you said. I mean, so that is a lot of time together, a lot of relationship building along with relationship ruptures at mm-hmm. times. Mm-hmm. But it's very relatable because I think you really did lean in to immerse yourself and make some shifts in your parenting. So this may be a hard question to answer, but I'm curious, would you identify, you know, some fundamental shifts that you made as a parent as you leaned in more?
Yeah. I mean, I've changed everything, honestly, about the way that I parent. It was funny. My husband and I were walking to the park the other day. We live in Brooklyn and Brooklyn parents are their own thing. But we're walking and I saw this woman pushing, you know, a stroller and her kid was maybe like 2.5 and was just in a full out meltdown. And this mom was so calm and like, oh, you're having a really hard time right now. And I was like, I just wanted to be like, oh my God, like bow down to her. Like, I was so impressed with how she just was like, yeah, you're having a hard time. And, you know, after we passed her, I turned to Darren. I was like, that was not me. Like I fought it every step of the way. Like I initially really looked at all of this as some failure on my part, you know, and it was so visible, you know, that this was a child having a hard time. And what did that mean about me? And so that was probably one of the biggest shifts. And I wish I had made it sooner. Like I hate the fact that I wasn't more understanding that my kid just didn't know how to regulate or really was so uncomfortable in his own body, you know, from a sensory perspective and was so overwhelmed. And I got frustrated by that. And that makes me really bummed out sometimes. So that was a mm-hmm. big shift for me when I, you know, realized, oh, my child doesn't have the skills or the capacity mm-hmm. to be different in this moment and in this situation. I'm the one who needs to adjust my expectations because I do have the capacity and the skills mm-hmm. to learn and grow and show up for this kid. So that was probably the biggest one. But I think kind of the overarching theme for me was that I am someone who likes to have certainty and to control things and to figure things out and make a plan and follow through and be successful. And so that has been just the ongoing learning for me is like, I can't control any of this. And the harder I try, the bigger the fail and the worse it's going to feel for everybody in my family. So it's just been this continuous letting go and willingness to lean into the discomfort and do my own work. Like that's been the past, 20 years of my life, basically.
Well, Debbie, we are kindred spirits because you just described me when you just described yourself. I like certainty. I like a plan. I like to fix things. That's not really compatible with parenting, right? And I think, I've had the similar journey where my challenges in parenting in terms of facing my own issues has propelled me in my parenting writing and becoming a resource for parents. Mm-hmm. So I think it's using our own pain to heal us, ourselves, and others, right?
Absolutely. I mean, before I did this, I wrote books for teenagers. I've had multiple careers, just so we'll put it out there. But before this career, the career just prior was, maybe 8 years I was writing books for teens and tween girls. And I was doing that and speaking at conferences and creating content for girls. It was because I was a disaster as a teen girl. And I really didn't start to feel good about myself and realize that I actually had value and worth as a human until I was like almost 30. And so I was like, I want to help other younger girls kind of fast forward through some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's just the way I always show up. I try to take what I've learned and my hard-won wisdom and help other people maybe skip some of the most painful stuff. So then I just turned my attention towards parenting neurodivergent kids and did the same thing.
Well, I see a lot of parallels though, because I think the heart of your message is really viewing our child as perfect as they are, right? Mm-hmm. And how we all need someone to view us that way in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the ultimate sense of acceptance and that we are good enough just as we are in the world right now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, now I'm hearing Mark Darcy as you said that from Bridget Jones' Diary. I quite like you just as you are. But no, you're absolutely right. We all, and this is what Tina Payne Bryson and Dan Siegel write about in their book, in many of their books, but The Power of Showing Up, that we all want to feel seen. Like that need to feel truly seen it's critical to our healthy attachment, to our feeling like we belong and that we have value. And I think that wasn't a priority, for a lot of the adults in my life growing up to make sure that I felt that way. And I know that's a pretty universal experience for people in, a certain generation for sure.
Right. Well, and I think I've learned a lot in my own work and this echoed in your messaging as well. When our children feel that they're seen and understood, it's so much easier to work through the challenging times. Mm-hmm. When there's that foundation of, I know you get me, most of the time at least, mm-hmm. it's more of a good faith partnership on those tougher days.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That sense of feeling just emotionally safe, right? And that's, I like to give a shout out to Dr. John Duffy, who wrote this wonderful book, Parenting the New Teen in the Age of Anxiety. And that was kind of the core message for him when you're raising teens and adolescents is how important that deep connection is. It's everything. And a big part of that is making sure that our kids know that we have their back, that we really truly get and see who they are, and that we'll always be a safe place for them to share anything. And as our kids get older, that becomes more and more critical, right?
Yep, it does, for their own safety.
Yeah.
I mean, it becomes higher and higher stakes. They're
yes.
not under our wing as closely. Mm-hmm. They're more out in the world without us. And so for them to feel safe coming back to us to share struggle becomes especially important.
Yeah.
Small behaviors can make a big difference in our health and well-being. Most of us work so many hours each week that we should think about how our work habits affect our bodies. Being able to stand sometimes while I work has made a huge difference for me. Uplift Desks has created high-quality office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. My Uplift standing desk allows me to easily transition from sitting to standing while I work with just the push of a button. I feel so much better than when I sit all day, and it helps me recharge to change positions when I get tired in the afternoon. In addition to standing desks, Uplift offers ergonomic office seating, storage systems, even walking treadmills for your desk. You can get free shipping with no hassles, free 30-day returns and return shipping, and a 15-year warranty. Remember, by supporting our sponsors, you're supporting the podcast. Visit upliftdesk.com/POTC for 5% off your order. That's UPLIFT desk.com/POTC to get 5% off your entire order.
We all know there are trade-offs in life, like having to drive a little further to save on gas or groceries. But when it comes to your health, you shouldn't have to trade off. So don't go back to that one doctor who's always late and rushes through your appointment just because they're close by or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. You can search by location, availability, insurance, literally no trade-offs here because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. My kid's pediatrician is retiring this summer, so you can bet I will be using ZocDoc to find someone new who we all love and trust. So go to ZocDoc.com/POTC and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/POTC. ZocDoc.com/POTC.
So you get into some really great common parenting experiences, and then some tips and strategies for making those mindset shifts that we kind of touched on. So I wanted to start with one that I think is also really fundamental, which is this idea of letting go of what others think. And I'm going to share a quote that I so related to, and I think a lot of parents will relate to this. You said, "Asher wasn't just normal challenging. He was challenging. It was like a compulsion, my need for other people to get it." Mm-hmm. And you talk about self-conscious versus conscious parenting in the context of raising differently wired kids. So let's talk more about why that's so important, that distinction.
Yeah, I mean, I struggled so much and was so self-conscious, I think, you know, again, tying back into my need to feel seen, right? Or that I had value or that I was good enough, which is something I never felt like. And being seen as someone who was capable, I felt so judged when the outward appearance wasn't what I wanted to project. And yeah, it was really, really difficult for me. And as Ash got older, became even more challenging because then the kind of the difference between the expectations and what was really happening seemed to get larger and larger. I was living in the Netherlands for those kind of critical years. And, you know, people would just look at me or say, like, your child is way too old to be doing that kind of thing. Some of my worst, I don't know if they were my worst parenting moments, but some that I still kind of cringe when I think about were in those situations where I felt like I really had to over explain, well, you don't really get it. Like, this is what's really going on. This isn't about me at all. Like, I am rocking it. If you knew what I was going through, you would know how good I am at parenting. And so I was really, self-conscious about everything. And so I think that pivot to being aware, like part of being a conscious parent is being aware, this is a huge trigger for me. So how can I do my own work so that I don't throw my kid under the bus, and actually I show up for my kid in those difficult moments, and I prioritize my child's experience and emotional safety in those situations? And how do I kind of consciously be that parent? But it's something you have to choose to do every day to do the work. And, you know, as I always say, we get plenty of opportunity to practice. That's the good news. But it is a conscious choice to say, I know this about myself. This is hard for me. I'm going to choose to explore that on my own and continue to work on better showing up for the child that I have.
Well, I remember when my son was four, we were at this museum known to be, you know, a quiet place. And I was with my in-laws. There's a whole group of us. And he had a complete meltdown, you know, yelling on the floor. And I remember this moment of realizing I do have a choice here of how I respond. I can try and be really tough with him to get him to cut it out and stop it and be quiet. And I know him well enough to know that will not work. Like, things will just escalate. Mm-hmm. And so I can't worry about what anyone else is thinking right now. And I'm going to scoop him up. Mm-hmm. I'm going to sit him on my lap quietly and be quiet with him until he can settle mm-hmm. himself.
Yeah.
So I, in that moment, remember that choice of, I'm not going to worry about judgment right now.
Yeah.
Because that's not going to serve us. And it's going to make it worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Like pouring gasoline on a fire. And when my kid was four and doing that, I didn't make that choice. I would get so triggered myself. And then my nervous system, you know, we just, my mm-hmm. kid and I are still, we're so connected. Like, it's really like the way that we mirror each other. It's really, mm-hmm. you know, at least I know it now. So I use right. it to my advantage, to our advantage, but I would just be so triggered. And so I would like kind of fake be calm, but underneath mm-hmm. I was ready to explode. And so we really struggled in those years. And I think, you know, what you did, you know, is the way to do it, or even just having an exit plan. Like, I think being willing to ditch the plan is a huge thing. And huge. Just yeah. knowing that it's okay. Like, we're going to, you know, just always centering back to what matters in this moment. The only thing that matters when our kid is having a really hard time and they're dysregulated in that way, and we know they're dysregulated because their system is just, you know, their nervous system is fried. They can't do anything different. So that we have to step in and we have to try to co-regulate with them and prioritize getting them back to calm. That's all that matters. There's nothing else that we can do in that situation that isn't going to be potentially more harmful, right, to our child.
And explosive.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Right. Well, for the record, that was my third child. So I had had a lot of practice by then.
Oh, that makes me feel better. Okay.
So many years. The other theme that you bring up that I really related to was this: recognize when you're fighting reality. Mm. And so a big thing I have felt and thought myself, and I hear from a lot of parents, is, well, they shouldn't act like that, mm-hmm. right? There's a should. There's a lot of shoulds. Mm-hmm. And I do want to point out, just from the scientific perspective, that from decades of research on ADHD, for example, on average, kids are functioning 30% lower than their chronological age for ADHD. Mm-hmm. Autism is by nature a developmental delay mm-hmm. in the sense that there are important skills that are just delayed from their chronological age. Mm-hmm. So we really, when we're talking about knowing our kids and seeing what they're capable of, it's remembering that their skills are not necessarily matching their chronological age.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that in there. But I think really reframing shoulds is an important part of parenting yeah. all kids
yeah.
and especially these kids.
Yeah. I think should... anytime, like, I encourage people to banish that word altogether yeah. from their vocabulary, but anytime we're saying should, needs to, has to, must, like, any of those kind of absolute words are definitely signals that we are fighting reality. Because the truth is, and I shared this story in the book, I do remember my husband saying, well, he has to be able to, you know, to calm down more quickly. He needs to be able to deal with disappointment better. And I remember just saying, and he's not. Like, right. He isn't. So
the reality is.
Yeah. So a lot of the things I do in the book and in my work at Tilt Parenting, there are these little things, these subtle things, but once you notice them, they can kind of start to blow open your world and the shifts really start to happen. So if you realize, I just said, well, he should be able to, you know, get out of the house after 5 reminders. And so then when he doesn't, then we're super frustrated and, you know, we're placing these demands and then our kid feels that they're a disappointment and nobody wins in that situation. So then we notice, okay, there's a lagging skill here. There's something going on that's making my kid get stuck. And then of course we use Dr. Ross Green's like collaborative proactive solutions model. And we figure out what is that lagging skill or skills and how can we start to scaffold and help our kid learn that thing. So, but I think this idea of fighting reality, and there's a quote I have in the book from Byron Katie. She says, when you fight reality, you lose, but only 100% of the time. And I just love that because it's true. Like, there's no winning. If we're arguing with what's actually going on, then we're never going to be happy. So we have to understand where are we arguing? Where are we parenting the child we wish we had as opposed to the child we have? And how can we narrow that gap so that we're more showing up for the human in front of us?
Yeah. And in psychology world, we would call that resistance versus acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this idea of resisting reality causes so much more suffering.
Yes.
Than the acceptance of this is what is.
Mm-hmm. And acceptance is not easy. And it's also, and I have a chapter on that in the book, but it's also not a once and done thing. It is just like we talked about consciously showing up. It's a daily intention to navigate areas where we are not reconciling who this child is and making a choice to better understand, to better lean in that moment. So it's a daily action to accept who our child is.
Right. And we'll make the distinction that we're not saying we're accepting everything they do and there's no teaching around, you know, more positive, productive showing up in the world. It's more that when they're completely dysregulated and in that emotional haywire space, they're not learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really balancing those, I think, but this is all of parenting, right? Mm-hmm. It's like what do we sort of work on as skill development and important change? So we're not just saying, you know, well, we're just accepting our kids for who they are. And by the time they're 18, they'll be okay. We're not going to do anything. This is still a very active parenting process. Right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's not like, you know, putting our hands up like, oh, well, like, you know, that's the way it goes. That's not, that is not acceptance either. It's more recognizing where are we not really seeing who this kid is. And once we understand that, then we can get curious about where they are right now and how can we scaffold skill development and really get to know who they are on such a deep level that we can fluidly move through learning opportunities and then recognize, oh, today's not the day for this, or, oh, but I see an opening. Let's work on this. So and which is going back to that idea of being deeply connected, the more closely attuned to our child we are, the better able we'll be to capitalize on those learning opportunities.
You tell this story that I will remember always. It just captures perfectly a really easy, important pivot that parents can make in the moment. And that is this example you call a lost in translation example. And a little boy was like at the table and he knocked over a thing of milk and everyone got down on him. And there was one adult at the table, I think an aunt or something, who said, "What were you trying to do?"
Yeah.
And he was able to say, "I was trying to help pass the butter," or something. And so it's remembering, you know, what happens on the surface, maybe missing what was going on inside for that child, and to try and tune into that.
Yeah. And I think it was my friend, he's an ADHD coach in Denmark. His name is Anders Ronau. He shared that story with me. And there was someone else at the table who was like, what were you thinking? Right? Which is often the default when we see our kid do something that's like, seems like it came out of nowhere and it didn't make any sense. And it had a negative, you know, side effect, like spilling gravy all over the table. But I agree with you. What were you trying to do? What a beautiful question. Mm-hmm. And there's always a reason. There is always a reason why our kids are doing what they're doing. And as you know, Dr. Mona Della Hook says, there's very, very little behavior that is purposefully manipulative or negative, right? There's that's the rare circumstance. So most of the time, if your child does something that, you know, just comes out of left field and is disruptive or is problematic or is quote unquote bad behavior, all we really want to do is get curious, like, oh, what were you trying to do? What was your goal here? And we can start to then hone in on, you know, what's the need that wasn't being met, or what is that lagging skill?
Yeah, or what there was a function of the behavior. Yeah. We just don't know what it was.
Yeah.
And it's exploring that. I think the beauty of that is it also helps a child develop self-awareness and insight. If we're asking those questions and helping them check in with themselves of, oh, what was going on? Because they may have to think a little bit about what led up to that moment.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that is something, you know, that I talk a lot about in the book, is knowing that everything is a learning opportunity. And you know, we want our kids to really get curious about who they are. So asking those kinds of questions where they can reflect and think, oh, yeah, what was I trying to do? Or why did I think that would work? Or, you know, where did I get stuck? Or where could it, you know, what could a different choice be in that moment? Those are all great ways to help our kids know themselves better.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about an example where my son, he won't do things that I know he can do, like independently, which for someone who's all about expecting independence in children is really fun, that like my own child's like, no, you can do that for me. I'm like, you can do it. But I realized, I tuned in finally and realized he was concerned about doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, like one thing is pouring his own cereal, and he's worried about making a mess. And he's, you know, I know there's a little perfectionism in him. And so it's sort of putting it all together. Mm-hmm. It's not lazy, right? So some parents might be like, why are you so lazy? You won't even pour your own cereal. And what's really going on is he doesn't want to make a big mess, embarrass himself, you know, cause more problems. And so he just backs off. And so in that example, there's the scaffolding of, well, let's do it together. Let's come up with tricks for how you won't spill. Like you can use your hand to get out the granola. And when the milk isn't as full, it's easier to pour. You know, there's little learning to go along with mm-hmm. it, so he doesn't get stuck there forever.
Yeah.
But it just kind of is that example of the why may be hard to find sometimes.
Yes. It's so true, which is why curiosity is so important for us to have as parents. And I'll just share, as you're sharing that story, I was thinking of, you know, my child is 19 now and is capable of doing a lot of things that I still end up doing. And every now and then I'll be like, gosh, I'm really like blowing this right now, because this is total learned helplessness. And my kid will go, it's not learned helplessness, but if you're going to do it, why would I do it if you're going to do it anyway? Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I get that. And so, but I also know there's a lot of anxiety around certain things. Mm-hmm. It does create stress. So of course, the easiest thing would be to let me do it. So that doesn't mean that I then say, okay, from now on, this is all you. What I do instead is I look for authentic moments where like, oh, I'm running late, I need your help, could you? And then I'll ask my kid to do X, Y, and Z out of nowhere. And you know, he'll step up to the plate and do it because I need help. It wasn't, you know, and so, and then I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, check, got that one, you know, learning moment, check, you know, but, and then I don't do it all the time, but I do it enough so that I know that my child is learning the skills and can do the things, right? And, but I'm also not placing, you know, I have a demand avoidant child. So I also try to navigate that balance of not putting so much demands on my kid that he's going to shut down.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yep. Yeah. And that's a really tricky one.
It is
really tricky.
It's tricky.
And I think parents are always seeking support for that one. So if listeners identify with that, you are not alone. I want to get a little bit into meaningful self-care for parents and caregivers. And I am one that rolls my eyes when we talk about self-care with parents because it's usually very superficial and not actually helpful. I actually usually avoid the term because I think it's turned into such a turnoff. Mm-hmm. But you have some really great ideas for self-care that's actually shifting thinking and mindset and expectations. And one thing I love that you said was we can be more relaxed during conflicts because we know the outcome isn't a reflection of how good a job we're doing. Mm. That has been part of my journey as well as a parent, as I've realized when I've let that go, how much less stressed I get in points of conflict. Mm-hmm. But I think that's an excellent example of where that simple, well, simple but not easy, mindset shift can then actually contribute to less stress. Mm-hmm. And that is self-care.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And just so you know, I too cringe at the term self-care. And I, in my club, when we do this as a theme, we call it conscious maintenance because that's what it is. It is maintenance. Like we can't neglect ourselves or there's no way we are going to survive this. No way. Our kids, all kids demand stuff from their parents, but neurodivergent kids demand so much from us. Like we can't phone it in. I mean, we can, but it's not going to feel good for us or for our families or for our kids. And we're not going to get the outcomes that we want. So in order to be able to really show up, we have to prioritize ourselves. And, you know, for me, I can't stop moving, right? That's part of the way I've always, you know, dealt with stress is I run, I work out, like I walk really fast. Like I'm just always doing things. So that to me is all self-care. I do it while listening to like podcasts at 2x the speed. Like that to me is like my self-care. But I also have really leaned hard into self-compassion and just being so kind to myself and just acknowledging, like saying to myself, it makes sense that you're feeling this way. This is really hard. And even just giving myself permission to feel like a failure or guilty or all the, you know, the negative emotions that come up when you're parenting a child who isn't really thriving, you know, we have to be so gentle on ourselves and remind ourselves we're doing the best we can. And then really stepping up, tending to our own nervous systems, you know, whether that's yoga or breathing or just even taking a shower with the door closed and just kind of, you know, checking out and just like having a sensory experience that feels nice. All of that stuff matters. And it's non-negotiable. I hear from so many parents, you probably do too, about they're just burned out. They're done, especially after what we've been through over the past couple of years. And I think, again, and you know, you said you're similar in this way, so maybe you have a similar experience. I'm really good at like powering through and pushing through, and I can do it. And inside, I'm not doing well. And I really, for me, I'll just share personally, like I hit a wall by the end of the year that I had been avoiding, because I'm like, no, I know all the tools. I can do everything. And I hit such a wall where I kind of realized, oh, this is actually going to, like, I'm not going to live as long if I keep operating at this level. It's just not healthy to have your nervous system be activated all the time.
Because that involves cortisol.
Yeah.
And when cortisol is raised for chronic periods of time, that has serious health implications. Yeah. So if there's anything to motivate parents, and I am by training a health psychologist, so I'm very in tune with the interplay between our biology and our psychology. And that has really been my own motivation as well, to really tune into my stress levels and how it's affecting my body.
Yeah.
And then doing all the things that, like you said, maintenance. This isn't once a month getting a massage. That is not going to cut it, right? It's day to day what is going to be like TLC for the nervous system with everything that all of us parents these days are trying to manage. There's so much input all the time.
Yeah. Yes. That's great. I love that you have that focus. And, you know, for me, it's been acupuncture has helped me kind of reset my system, but I got back into yoga. I can't meditate. I've tried. It is just not happening. Okay. I'm like, my mind like starts bing as soon as I try. But yoga, restorative yoga has been, I think it saved my life over the past few months. So, but yes, it is. And just to, again, be real, it could be a monthly massage, but put on a song that you like. Like I can put on like Me and Bobby McGee by Janis Joplin, and I will just completely freak out. Like I will dance until I'm sweaty for that whole 4 minutes. And what a release that is, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, it fills me with joy. I get this stuff worked out of my body, and it just kind of helps me get regular. So a song, it could be as
four
easy
minutes,
as a song.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So important. I wish we could talk forever. I feel like we have so much to share, but I want to end with this idea of how mainstream parenting guidance can be really frustrating for parents of differently wired kids. And as a psychologist myself, even in my own training, I know how these standard treatments or what's supposed to be the intervention can fall really flat, right? And I have to get flexible and understand each child in my office and how they're wired and functioning for what's going to actually be effective. But I just am really aware of how many parents and families with neurodivergence can feel left out of the parenting guidance world. Now, you have filled a big hole with your whole platform. But I know you're a big reader of parenting books. So can you share more just to validate this experience of parents of differently wired kids reading a lot of these books? Like, what do you think is missing and how can parenting authors do better?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, I do feel that a lot of the kind of general parenting books, and I do read like all of them, I get pitched them from my show and I'm very curious about it. And I think the tricky thing is we as parents of neurodivergent kids, we're always trying to like kind of cut through the weeds, like what's the nugget that I might be able to apply in my world. And sometimes the books, just like diversity in other areas, sometimes there's like kind of a mention here or mention there that feels we included that because it needs to be in here, but it's not, there's not a deep understanding actually of what's going on. And so I'll throw out the Julie Lithcott-Hames most recent book. She wrote the book How to Raise an Adult. Mm-hmm. But her most recent
book, on our podcast.
Yeah, she's wonderful. I love Julie. Her most recent book is How to Be an Adult. And she did such an incredible job of really being inclusive in all ways and representing, you know, gender and sexuality and neurodivergence and race, and just having it be, because that's who we are as people. We are complex people with, you know, multiple identities and intersectionality. And so I think that's just something to keep in mind in general for those parenting authors. Yeah. Just think about how could we be authentically inclusive and make sure that when we are talking about neurodivergence, that we're doing it in a neurodiversity affirming way, which is now kind of a buzzword and people don't even know what that means. But it basically means not medicalizing things. It means talking to neurodivergent adults and activists and understanding, you know, how to approach conversations in a way that is respectful and centers their experience and kind of going from there. And just, I think, recognizing that there's no like normal, right? There's no like normal. And then everybody else is over here. We all benefit from all of these things. This conversation is as applicable to a parent raising a neurotypical kid as a neurodivergent kid, because it's all the same. We all get triggered by the same things. We're all navigating really complex lives raising children.
Yep. And there is just a continuum of everything, right? And so within neurodivergent or quote unquote neurotypical, even within those two, there are like executive functioning is this huge basket and it can be all over the place for each kid, no matter where they fall on that quote unquote typical versus divergent, which again, I struggle with these terms too, because what is typical? What is normal? But I think it's that reminder of the complexity of every human being.
Yeah.
And we all share more than is different.
Yeah, absolutely. And we didn't even talk about mental health. I mean,
I know
the mental health of kids and teens today. So, and of course, there's a lot of co-occurrence of mental health challenges with neurodivergent kids, but also there's so many children, generally speaking, who are suffering right now.
So I'm curious, because we started with reality shows and my 14-year-old loves the show Love on the Spectrum. Are you familiar with it?
I've watched the Australian version. I have not watched the American version.
I'm curious because I've kind of wondered, you know, this is a mainstream media portrayal of autistic young adults. And is it sensitive? Is it voyeuristic? Is it helpful to the cause of increasing understanding and acceptance? Or is it further, you know, differentiating?
That is a great question. And, you know, as an holistic person, which means as a non-autistic person, I also can only share what I think is complicated about it and what I have heard. I think really, first of all, I know that Jennifer Cook, who I think is wonderful, she wrote the, she's written books for autistic teens. She's written books for autistic women, and she's an activist. She's wonderful. She's an advisor for that show, and I think she's done a wonderful job. And I think it's complicated because that show also, I have only watched the Australian version, but they use a social skills kind of curriculum as the foundation, which is very much based on social norms. This is how you engage in a conversation. This is how you, you know, show up to a date. This is, you know, this is the way to be. And I think there are many autistic adults who would reject that and say, when autistic people are together, we don't need those rules. We do our thing. We know how to communicate with each other. So I think it's complicated. And then on the other side, you know, you mentioned voyeuristic. I think that's complicated too, because does it create more understanding for the autistic experience? Probably. Do we need more visibility in that way? definitely more positive portrayals. And but we also don't want it to be, you know, what Emily Liddell talked about in her book on disability, inspiration porn, right? That it's something
exactly.
That, so yes. I so all that to say, as an holistic woman, I don't feel like I can say whether it's good or bad. I try to hold space for the complexities mm-hmm. of that show. And I don't know the right answer to that. It's an interesting dynamic and something interesting to think about.
I'm curious to see with my 14-year-old how it affects her in terms of how she relates to people that feel different from her mm-hmm. in the sense of one thing I think the show can possibly promote is this idea of the emotional experience is the same, mm-hmm. right? Like everyone wants to love and be loved, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the core of the human experience. And so is there a certain sharing that could be helpful and healing? But I think you're right. I think it's good discussion, right? Mm-hmm. I think it may be a good point of discussion within this work of deconstructing some of this media, and especially in this day and age mm-hmm. of so much media, mm-hmm. And our kids consuming so much media is being aware. Yeah.
And just, you know, to speak to your 14-year-old, I think this generation of kids are, they're just growing up with so much more openness and acceptance of mm-hmm. different ways of being. Again, whether it's, you know, related to neurodivergence or gender identity or sexuality, or, you know, it is very, they're just a very different, very cool generation in my mind. Yeah. So I could see how it would just be like, oh, that's interesting. Like,
right.
A deeper understanding. Cool. Whatever.
Yep.
You know?
Right. Very different from growing up in the 80s and having this whole, all this baggage attached to everything.
Yes. Exactly.
I think our kids don't have that baggage. Yeah. It's actually really refreshing. Yeah. As much as we worry about this generation, I think.
And they have their own challenges for sure related to all these things. But I do think seeing how open they are and authentic and being who they are is really inspiring to me.
Very. So I'm going to end with a scene from your book that I loved because I do this all the time. And that is watching your child sleep. Mm. And as a form of reset. So this is how the context you placed it in, is this idea of when they're asleep in their bed and it's calm and peaceful, having that moment of just looking at them and seeing them as you are incredible. Mm. You know, no matter what we went through today, you are an amazing person. And as we started, I think that's just what all of us need in our lives is people seeing us, flaws and all, no matter how hard the day was, that there's a perfection there mm-hmm. in the imperfections.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it was a lovely reset tip that I think other parents could benefit from.
That was so helpful for me to do that. And try to almost connect on a soul to soul level, you know, in that moment and the essence of who my child was and just lean into that love. And I also will just encourage parents listening to this to consider trying to have a light up moment every day. That's something I do with my child is making sure that there's an opportunity, whether it's coming up to the dinner table or picking up after school or something, where I just do my best to exude love and just really light up when I see my kids so they know how happy I am and full of joy that I get to be their parent, you know?
Yeah, I love that. It's like an unabashed adoration for a moment. They don't have to do anything for it. They don't have to earn anything. It's just there.
Yeah.
And you're just really happy to be around them.
Yeah.
I love that. So thank you so much, Debbie, for your time today and your advocacy every day. What you have built in the last few years is extraordinary. We've been really fortunate to have you on Psychologist Off the Clock. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you want to add to the conversation?
Well, first of all, thank you for this conversation. It was really fun to go deep into some of these things and, explore this. I appreciated it. I would just say that, anyone listening to this show, you've got this. It is the most humbling experience to be a parent, and we can often just feel like we're getting it wrong and we've made bad decisions and we would have done things differently if only we'd known X, Y, or Z. And I just want to encourage you to treat yourself with grace and kindness and know that you're exactly the parent that your child needs.
Right. Our child is exactly the right person for them, and we are exactly the right parent. And hey, you know what? Our kids are lucky to have us. I'm going to say that.
1,000%. Yes.
All right, Debbie. So where can people find you?
So the best place for everything is tiltparenting.com. You can find all 360 plus podcast episodes, including the one that we did together, Emily. And you can read the first chapter of my book and learn about my Differently Wired Club community. And there's a ton of free resources on there as well. So tiltparenting.com.
Yeah, it's amazing. There are all these groups all over the country. I mean, it's really incredible what you have developed. So thank you for what you have contributed to the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. If you enjoy our podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review or contributing on Patreon.
You can get more psychology tips by subscribing to our newsletter and connecting with us on social media.
We'd like to thank our podcast production manager, Jadine Stout-Williams.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources page of our website, offtheclockpsych.com.